Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs digest. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by our fine friends over at Tenable Network Security, so big thanks to them. And Tenable's very own Marcus Ranham will be along in this week's sponsor interview to talk about detection concepts. He pulls on his grumpy pants and doles out some stone-cold old-school advice for people out there building networks. That is actually a very fun interview coming up a bit later. This week's feature interview is a little bit left of field. With all this talk about hacking planes flying around, I just realised what a terrible pun that is. But yes, with all of the talk about plane hacking over the last couple of months, I thought it might be a great idea to talk to an actual airliner pilot. So this week, we're joined by an Australian Airbus pilot. He works for an Asian airline, but was in Australia recently, and I caught up with him to ask for his thoughts on the topic. As you'll hear, there's a little bit more to an Airbus than it just being a flying computer. It's more like a flying computer warehouse with multiple redundant systems. Our anonymous pilot says stopping a hacker on a plane might be as simple as just killing power to the cabin with a flick of the switch. But he says there are no procedures or training around troubleshooting involving malicious attackers. And in such a heavily process-oriented environment, that could cause problems. It's an InfoSec interview with someone who knows absolutely nothing about InfoSec, and it's actually quite illuminating, and it is coming up after the news. Speaking of which, it's time to recap the week's information security news now with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, it's good to know that the fine people at the UK Signals Intelligence Agency, the GCHQ, they are fighting the good fight. They are storing, sifting, analysing the communications of terrorists. And, oh, what's this? Oh, yeah, also Amnesty International. They've been spying on Amnesty International. Good work.
Yes, there was this case, I think we talked about a little while ago, where a group of NGOs had basically filed a suit asking the UK government, you know, if they had been spied on. The outcome of this turned out to be that, yes, amongst other things, Amnesty International was one of the targets of GCHQ's intercept, although it's not 100% clear whether this was specifically targeted or was just the kind of side effect of the fact that, well, you know, you're doing full take, you're taking everybody's emails.
Exactly.
And, you know, Amnesty International may in fact not be the special snowflake that it wishes it was. It's not clear which way that goes, but either way, in the context of the Vassanar arrangement covering, you know, software for spying on activist organizations like Amnesty, GCHQ doing it is a little bit, at the very least, ironic, and you know, I guess hypocrisy is a word you could use.
Hypocrisy is a word you could use. But yeah, look, I mean, as you say, it's impossible to know whether or not this was some sort of targeted op, you know, and people were, you know, analysts were reading Amnesty International people's email. But you know, when you're doing full take, that's exactly kind of what it means. So, yay. But still, not exactly a headline that the British government would be terribly happy to see.
No, you look like a dick, the British government.
Yes, you do look like a dick. David Cameron, mind you, has been piping up recently saying, you know, talking about how encryption is evil and for terrorists again. So, you know, we'll keep an eye on that. And if, you know, if they can actually manage to draft a policy, I guess we'll cover it then.
Yeah, they'll require all terrorists to use the clipper chip. I think that's where they'll head.
Meanwhile, a private investigator in the United States has been dinged for snooping on the email of Scientology critics. Gee, I wonder who he was working for.
Yeah, this guy had, this private investigator had solicited hacking services from forums where one can solicit such things to break into the email accounts of something like up to 50 people. And a couple of the victims of this realized that the only thing that they had in common was that they were both, you know, high profile critics of Scientology. And this guy has been sentenced now and received 3 months imprisonment, 3 years of supervised probation, and a $1,000 fine.
Well, he also had to forfeit his $5,000 fee for owning everyone's email.
You'd think the Scientologists could have paid him a bit more, wouldn't you? $5,000 seems a bit stingy.
Well, look, it seems like a really lenient sentence in the context of the US judicial system, given...
It really does.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you just wonder, like, this guy, maybe they do have some connections, those Scientologists, you know? maybe they had some dirt on the judge, you know, from some other private private investigator.
Because, you know? Yeah, I mean, certainly compared to, I mean, like, I guess it's not a direct comparison, but, you know, like Barrett Brown or the kind of stuff they threw at Aaron Swartz or, I mean, heaven forbid, even Weave, right? I mean,
yeah.
And yet, this guy, you know, did, I guess, solicited regular straightforward hacking and gets 3 months in jail. Doesn't seem, yeah, seems a little out of whack.
So this guy, Eric Saldiaraga, good luck to you. Let's hope the anonymous beast doesn't awaken to make your life hell.
Mm-hmm. Let's hope.
Ah, now it's not just GCHQ in the news for doing all sorts of snooping. The frogs are getting in on the action. It's nice to see an APT campaign originating from a Western nation that doesn't come from the UK or the US. We are talking, of course, about the Dino espionage malware, which the headline from Ars points out has a French connection. Zing.
Yeah, so there's a write-up coming out of ESET, antivirus and research, security research company in Slovakia, building on some earlier research into this family of malware called the Animal Farm espionage group, or the Animal Farm malware, which has a number of tells which suggest that it has ties to French intelligence. Been this, you know, this family of malware, which is primarily focused on information stealing, you know, rummaging through doc files on people's boxes and sending them off to command and control somewhere else, has a number of things that point to French involvement. Some you know, French language paths where there's paths in the binaries that they've compiled, some error messages that are not in particularly good English, and a few other things. There was quite a good talk at CISCAN this year, reverse engineering this particular family of malware, and it does have some quite interesting features in terms of storing all its stolen data in a RAM disk that's then encrypted when it gets stored down to survive a reboot, that kind of thing. So yeah, quite an interesting piece of malware, and yeah, I mean, it's the, you know, of the level of sophistication you would expect from a government operation, and it's been found in, you know, the sorts of targets you would expect French intelligence to be interested in, you know, Iran and Syria, that kind of thing.
Turning our attentions to WikiLeaks, and it appears that they've had some fresh leaks come out of the NSA which point to continued spying against Angela Merkel. You know, I guess we shouldn't really be surprised that the Americans are spying on the Germans, because they have a track record of spying on the Germans.
Well, kind of exactly, yeah. And at least in this case, I suppose, thanks to WikiLeaks, we, you know, compared to the earlier story about Amnesty International, at least in this case, we know quite specifically what things they are reading out of Angela Merkel's life. One of the examples that WikiLeaks published is, you know, a summary of her discussion with her personal assistant about the state of the, you know, financial crisis in the Eurozone and with Greece a couple of years ago. So it does give you some quite specific examples of what sort of intelligence they are pulling out of that. And, you know, I don't know that we're surprised, really, that, you know, the NSA is spying on world leaders to use as information sources for decision-making. But, yeah, it's got to be awkward domestically in Germany.
That's sort of what those agencies are for. So anyway.
Well, kind of, yeah, right? I mean, SIGINT is absolutely going to SIGINT. This is what they do.
Yeah, well, it is, you know, decision-making support for, you know, leaders. That's what they use those toys for. But, you know, the NSA uses their toys for a few more things. Apparently, you know how there was much fanfare and everyone was real happy when the United States shut down its metadata, you know, phone big database thing that they've been doing, the most controversial thing that was made known through the Snowden dumps. Well, apparently they've sort of reinstated it just until November, just until they can get their ducks in a row. So apparently that program is continuing.
Yeah, they totally shut it down, apart from the 6 months that it might take to, you know, think about shutting it down. The FISA court have decided that it was absolutely fine for it to continue for that 6 month period. So
Yeah. Let's see what happens in 6 months. Now, meanwhile, the shenanigans continue over at OPM, of course, after the breach. And, you know, we've seen this happen quite a lot in similar circumstances. You know, of course, they're rolling incident response and they're starting to unplug things, okay, because they've found vulnerabilities in all sorts of, you know, various bits of their network and their apps. And they've just taken down the portal that allows people to submit background information for security checks because they're like, yeah, this thing is vulnerable. So we're just going to pull the plug on it for now.
Yeah, which, I mean, given the article we were referring to here actually was published on Ars Technica, and Ars has done quite a good job of covering the OPM breach. And one of the things that they mentioned was that this particular piece of software actually was built on Adobe JRun 4, which is a Java web app server that was end of life some time ago, I believe.
I remember that summer. It was a glorious time.
Some of the other apps are, you know, Cold Fusion. Anyone of the listeners who is a pen tester and gets called in to review an app that's built on Cold Fusion or ancient end of life dead Java, you know, app containers is going to say, like, this is bad. It's unsupportable. You know, you need to turn it off and think about the bad things that you've done. And clearly someone has been paid to say exactly that to OPM. And what's interesting is that OPM is still maintaining that this particular problem, the fact that, you know, their core business application for processing backend information is unsuitable for purpose, was unrelated to the data breach they've suffered. So how about that?
Well, it probably is, right? But it just goes to show you that they weren't uniformly doing things the right way, I'm guessing, is the takeaway from this. Which I guess shouldn't come as any huge surprise. No. And of course, there is a class action lawsuit pending.
Inevitably.
Yeah, inevitably. I mean, this is what happens in the United States when there's a data breach. There is a lawsuit, but, you know, it's a stick that Americans are used to waving around. So that'll give us something fun to keep an eye on over the next couple of years, I guess. Oh, to some exciting news. Mudge, Peter Zatko, of course, who used to run programs at DARPA. Then he jetted off to Google for a short stint there. He's actually launching a cyber underwriters labs for the White House. Now, this is, you know, this is a certification and testing scheme, making sure things are fit for purpose. This could really go somewhere, I think. You know, you've got a guy like that with a proven track record of not just being a good hacker, but of being a guy who knows how to navigate Washington. The sky is the limit, really, for what Mudge can do here, because the vendors are going to have to listen to him.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly compared to the alternatives here, which is the kind of certification schemes we've seen run by industry, which have been complete rubbish, or things that have come out of the government traditionally in the style of Red Book or
Common Criteria.
Common Criteria, that kind of thing. I
mean, jeez, wasn't that a waste of time?
well, exactly right. So, I mean, something that actually has an actual hacker at the helm is about the only option here, right? Someone who is actually, you know, capable of being somewhat uncompromising about it, because we don't want to get to the point where we are with, you know, that who's the people who do the firewall certifications with it? It is complete rubbish. No, I forget. Phipps obviously is another example of doing it wrong. So there is a litany of examples of having done it wrong in this space, and I think, you know, Mudge of anyone, I guess, is better equipped than average to not completely screw it up. But yeah, we have to wait and see, you know, how well it's funded, how much traction it gets. But yeah, I suppose quietly hopeful. I mean, certainly when, you know, the run of stories we're about to talk about in a second, where in which security products absolutely make everything worse, is exactly the sort of problem that this kind of organization could be in a position to solve. Although really, I mean, when Cisco submits their appliance that does all of the rubbish things we're about to talk about, you know, whether they would, you know, this underwriters lab would actually be in a position to say, actually, no, this thing is not fit for purpose, go away and come back when you've actually, you know, done any sort of quality engineering work. We'll see, I guess.
Well, I did reach out to Mudge. I sent him an email and he did reply, and he said that he would be available for an interview sometime around August. So hopefully we can have him on the show then, and he can tell us what his approach is going to be. So that's something exciting to look forward to. But as you did allude to, there is this middle section of the news here, which is just a litany of fail. It's like wall-to-wall fail. We'll start with the good news. Samsung is apparently going to stop disabling Windows updates. So gee, thanks, guys. They're rolling out an update for that in the next few days.
Yeah, well, congratulations, Samsung. Really good stuff there for not doing a dumb thing again.
And yet, we move on to the next story. And LG have a terrible way of validating SSL certs that causes them all sorts of app updating problems. Yay, it's a very similar sort of issue to the Samsung one we spoke about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, this is the update process for the LG crapware on their LG phones. It does not validate SSL certs whilst updating itself, allows ARB code injection for a man in the middle, you know, essentially same net result as the Samsung keyboard. So I know I'm surprised to see yet another member of the Android ecosystem screwing it up in exactly the same way as everybody else.
Well, let's move over to Amazon now.
Oh, hang on a second. Well, what are they doing here? Failing to check SSL certs whilst updating their rubbish Android knockoff phone. How about that? Yes, it's the Amazon Fire. They've released an update which fixes their update process. So let's hope no one man in the middle's your update.
So well done, Samsung. Well done, LG. Well done, Amazon. I mean, geez, you know, it's just your head wants to. I mean, I remember I sent you the news list this morning and you said you were going to be on a bus trying not to bang your head into the seat in front of you. How did you go with that?
I sat actually especially in the seat that's meant for wheelchair people, so you can't reach the seat in front, thus saving myself the injury to my forehead.
There you go. I had you pictured as being pretty bloodied and bruised at this point. Now, look, we're going to continue with This Week in Fail and turn our attention to Cisco. Cisco has done a fantastic job with their SSH keys. In fact, deploying the same SSH keys across all of their appliances. Well done.
Yes. So, in fact, if you get hold of these SSH keys, you can just go ahead and log into these appliances. This is their Cisco Web Security Virtual Appliance, Cisco Email Security Virtual Appliance, and the Cisco Security Management Virtual Appliance. You'll notice, I guess, that all of these have security in their name and, in fact, make your security worse. So that's nice to see. This is embarrassing. And, of course, this is the exact same thing that we saw, was it F5 screw up a year ago? I'm sure we will see a number more of the appliance vendors screw up in the same way in the future. So if you are an appliance vendor, please just go look, see how your build process deals with keys. And if they are the same everywhere, that's bad.
Well, look, I mean, you know, it's not all bad news at Cisco. Oh, wait, it is. There's another problem with the Unified Communications Domain Manager. They have default static privileged account credentials. Yay. Yes. What year is this?
I know, right? And not only do they have default credentials that are static and you can just log in the device, apparently you can't change them without breaking it. Which, I mean, I don't even, Cisco. But this is the Cisco Unified Communications Domain Manager. If you're running like one of those big Cisco messaging systems in your organization, like, this is a really big deal. This is bad, Cisco. Bad Cisco. No biscuit.
Well, moving on to Microsoft, and it's time to talk about one of their awesome ideas. Oh, wait, I'm being told there's an update. It's a terrible idea, Adam.
This is such an awful idea. So there's been a couple of write-ups of this thing called Wi-Fi Sense, which is, of course, not at all sensible. In which modern Windows 8.1 and later devices and Windows phone devices will perhaps even automatically share wireless access credentials with your friends. So like the password for your home wireless network, it'll just like tell your buddies on presumably Skype or, you know, whatever other contact system you happen to be using that integrates with this, and just allow them to log into your network. It also will automatically log you into open wireless networks. And one of the features it mentions here is you can enable it to automatically accept on your behalf the terms and conditions of using other people's wireless networks.
Which, fantastic. I mean,
even if nothing else of the system was implemented, that is already like such an awful idea.
But you've got to admit, it's a perfectly, like, really well executed awful idea. Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
they've ticked every box, and you can actually enable it to share your wireless credentials with your Facebook friends.
The mechanics of this actual credential sharing process, by which it'll, you know, hand round your WPA PSK keys to your buddies, is not exactly specified. There's some, you know, kind of fluff about how it's totally encrypted. Obviously neglecting the fact that in order for the wireless supplicant on your device to actually authenticate to the network, it has to have that password to derive the key material for the pairwise master key, blah, blah, blah. It has the key, Microsoft. It doesn't matter what your fax says. You're giving other people the key. It doesn't matter whether you pretend that you can't see it. You can see it.
Exactly. Pulling that out of the registry ain't going to be that much of a challenge, I'm guessing.
No, it's an awful idea. Don't do it.
At least we can talk about one company that's doing things absolutely right. Of course, I'm talking about Sophos. Oh, wait. I'm being told that's not correct. They're doing it wrong, too. This one is like... That's my mind blowing. This one's just like.
So apparently, Sophos pushed out an update for their web content filtering appliance thingy that was going to block, amongst other things, SSLv3 to disable some of the Poodle and various other SSL downgrade attacks we've seen. So they pushed it out, turning off SSLv3. Which would otherwise be fine, except for a couple of facts. One, plenty of people did not expect this, and it broke a bunch of things. One of the examples is a big call center in Australia, apparently. All of their Citrix clients stopped working because only the most latest Citrix client happens to support not SSLv3, so it broke a bunch of stuff. And then the second bit that made it even better was you couldn't roll this update back, which...
48 hours of fun!
Yeah, hours of fun. So emergency Citrix client updates enterprise-wide for a number of people, I'm sure, who are running Sophos appliances, thus greatly improving the availability portion of their security triad, I'm sure.
Now, look, this is actually no bullshit. A good news story. NIST has dropped support for the dual EC RNG, which is, I'm kind of surprised it's taken this long, but go NIST. Better late than never.
Yeah, it has taken a little while to get there, to get rid of the allegedly NSA backdoored random number generator from the recommendations. But yes, it is now no longer in the recommended algorithms list. That's the single piece of good news I think we have this week.
Now, I think this one also falls into the category of good news, actually.
Actually, that's true. You're right. This is good news.
Now, look, there's been a stack of data breaches. To be honest, we don't actually try to comprehensively cover data breaches in this program because there are just so many of them. You just go to Krebs and there's like, yeah, that's what he's been doing this week, is every day writing up a story about some data breaches. But apparently Trump hotel properties, of course, belonging to Donald Trump, US presidential campaign Donald Trump. You know, he's the guy who got up recently and started saying how Mexicans were like dirty, filthy people who are rapists and criminals. That Donald Trump, amazingly enough, like no one from his own party seems to be having a go at him for that, which just makes me, again, pew,
pew. Apparently he's doing well, isn't he, with the Republicans? Like he is actually like that. They like that. Well, I guess I'm not surprised. But yeah, anyway,
his hotels got owned, and that's great because he's a racist, sad pile of hair, and I don't like him.
No, I also don't like him. But anyway, if you had the misfortune of staying at one of his, I'm presuming, overpriced and fancy hotels. Tacky overpriced hotels. Then yes, your credit card may well have been breached, and you can join the crowd of everybody else who said their credit card breached.
And you can also join the crowd of everyone else who says that Donald Trump guy is a total dick.
Although you should be reassured by a statement from Donald's third child, Eric Trump, who I'm sure is also not a complete twat, saying that he has committed to safeguarding all guests' personal information and will continue to do so vigilantly, presumably in the same style that he's currently been doing it, i.e. not at all.
Cisco has acquired OpenDNS, which is kind of a big deal, right?
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it? Because I mean, OpenDNS is kind of started out as a public DNS service, and then has leveraged that very large pool of DNS queries into sort of I guess you'd call it threat intelligence these days.
Threat intelligence.
Anyway, so Cisco has bought that particular pile of derp. Although not that OpenDNS is a pile of dirt, but threat intelligence itself, perhaps a pile of dirt. Anyway, Cisco has bought it. It's not quite clear what that's going to mean for people using OpenDNS for the source of all the data that they kind of rely on, and then onwards from there. I mean, Cisco's acquisitions in the security space, I suppose, have gone not awfully. It remains to be seen whether or not they managed to screw this one up, I guess.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the only company that seems to do good acquisitions is EMC. You know, they picked up VMware, they picked up RSA, and they basically buy these companies, they leave them alone. I mean, this is a good thing, right?
Yeah. Whereas, I mean, I'm not sure how well, say, Cisco's purchase of SourceFire went. I mean, how much have we heard out of SourceFire?
Yeah, not much, hey? They just got absorbed. I tells you. And now I'm probably going to get a whole bunch of angry emails from SourceFire people who are in Cisco going, we're still here, goddammit. Now, look, there's this protocol, RIPv1, which I'd never heard of. Apparently it's a deprecated protocol. It's a routing protocol. It's been brought back. It's been dusted off taken off the shelf and dusted off, and it's being used in DDoS attacks. Tell me about this.
This is a beautiful, beautiful story. Yeah, RIP is a classic rubbish routing protocol for design, for relatively simple route distribution. It's not a thing you would use in any modern internet connected route exchange. It's kind of a thing you might see in sort of medium-sized corporate environments, but it's been around for a very long time and a bunch of embedded systems still implement it, and there's been some DDoS campaigns that are leveraging RIP for reflected denial of service attacks, so you can kind of send packets with a spoof source address of the target, and then the intermediate device that supports RIP will respond and send packets to your target for you. If there are routes being advertised, you might get a bit of traffic amplification. So it's kind of in the same category as NTP and SNMP, other things we've seen used for spoofed UDP, DDoS traffic amping, funny old legacy protocols. But it's just, RIP has a place in the hearts of lots of old network hackers as being a rubbish way to do all sorts of fun network tricks back in the old days. So it's kind of nice to see it, coming back.
It's nice to see it
back
in the headlines. I know that you came from ISP land, so I knew you'd have something to say on that one.
Yeah, comedy RIP. Oh, dear.
Apple has patched basically everything they make this week. There's an update, iOS 8.4. There's also OS 10, 10.10.4. So lots and lots of bugs there.
Yeah, like 30-something in iOS are security critical, and then 70-something in OS X, remote coding, and all sorts of things. So, yeah, you really want to patch all of the Apple things.
And the final bug of the week, and actually the last news item for the week, is there has been a guest-to-host escape bug in Xen, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. Yet another guest to host. Yet another guest to host Escape Inside Zen. Once again in the legacy emulated network driver codebase from the QEMU project, which is where we've seen.
Yeah. I mean, this sounded awfully familiar. It just made me think of the one that we spoke about a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, that code base, that QEMU, emulated hardware code base, has been the root of bugs in QEMU, in KVM, in Zen, and I imagine probably some of the other ones as well, because that code base has been reused everywhere and was never really intended for security critical environments, I don't think. But anyway, so Zen Project have put out a patch with a number of bugs fixed. They are apparently going to drop another one that's due in a few days, I think, actually.
July 7th, and they haven't said what it is, which makes you think it could be something really awesome. Are these ones are they proper punch through bare metal bugs?
Well, certainly the one in the PCNet network, emulated network card, does appear to be. I'm not sure about the rest of them, whether they're – I think there's some that are DOS. I don't know that there's any other straight-up guest or hosts, but we'll have to wait and see what this one is that's coming up soon.
Yeah, but either way, not features you want in your hypervisor.
Well, no, and if you're not one of the really big users of Zen that gets advanced notification like Amazon or whoever, if you're a smaller operator running, Zen virtual machines in your business, then, actually patching these things is quite a big deal.
Mm. All righty, mate, that's actually it for the week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us, and we will chat to you again next week.
We shall indeed. I'll talk to you then, Pat.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Up next, we are chatting with a guy I know. Let's call him John. John is an experienced Airbus pilot who flies for a commercial airline based out of Asia. He was recently in Australia, so I sat down with him to pick his brains on claims that flight systems can be hacked via in-flight entertainment systems, or the networks that in-flight entertainment systems are plumbed into. There seems to be an assumption in the InfoSec profession that an Airbus flight control system is some sort of horrible box running Windows XP embedded, but that actually couldn't really be further from the truth. As long-time listeners would know, my undergraduate degree was actually in electronics engineering, and when it comes to designing stuff like airliners, and to a greater extent, military aircraft, the consideration of what could possibly go wrong is always at the forefront of the designer's mind. What happens if the flight computer plays up? Might be a consideration. Okay, we'll put in three designed by different teams with different signal paths. These things are not designed like the average enterprise IT network for obvious reasons. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't legitimate security problems with aircraft. Chris Roberts got in trouble with the FBI for tweeting about spoofing ECAS messages. That's a Boeing system, the Engine Indicating and Crew Alerting System. The Airbus equivalent, which you'll hear mentioned throughout this interview, is ECAM, or Electronic Centralized Aircraft Monitoring. Now, these things are like a logging and alerting system for the pilots. If there's a warning or an error, it's the ECAS or ECAM warning that will alert the flight crew. These warnings usually trigger some sort of manual checklist. So yeah, you don't want an attacker flooding the cockpit with erroneous warnings. Now, the FBI also, in addition to the ECAS stuff, the FBI also claimed Roberts had stated during an interview that he issued a climb command by sending packets to the flight computer through the IFE system, a claim some find fishy and others find completely alarming. Well, I thought I'd talk to my Airbus flying buddy about all of this. He knows nothing about computer security, but he's very dedicated to his job and learning about the latest trends and developments in aviation. I disguised John's voice so he doesn't have to deal with any bullshit from his corporate overlords, and I started off by asking him if flight computer security is a topic that pilots ever discuss. And here's what he had to say.
Absolutely not. It's never brought up in conversation because it hasn't happened yet. So generally with aviation, until something happens, no procedure will be put in place to change anything. And if it's never happened, we don't need to talk about it.
It's funny, isn't it? Because it's a really safety-obsessed industry. Most of the training is really about how to handle events that could result in something bad happening. I mean, that is really a lot of what you do, isn't it?
It is, but with flying, particularly the new fly-by-wire aircraft, Boeing or Airbus will try and cover every single possible situation there is, and you'll cover that in all your flight training. And any new problem that happens later on, as it always does, problems present themselves all the time, you'll then face that in the simulator. So you won't actually practice any new procedures until it happens.
So, and this is the thing, right? I'm wondering, I'm guessing, actually, that failures of various systems or untrusted data finding its way into various systems is actually something that you drill for.
Not particularly. There's no procedure in place in our manuals for uncommanded ECAM messages. We can have failures of various computers, which would give us erroneous readouts, particularly with airspeed. That's probably the biggest one, but that's generally through an obstruction from...
like a bad pitot or something.
Yeah, exactly. But as far as getting ECAMs that don't exist, it just doesn't happen.
Now, the reason I refer specifically to untrusted input, which is, you know, a very big term in security, like computer security, untrusted input is a big thing. We always say never trust user input and stuff. So that's what causes a lot of issues. There was an issue involving an airliner. It was a Qantas airliner over Western Australia where untrusted input or erroneous bad input from one of the, I think it was like a altitude sensor or a speed sensor or something. Anyway, the flight management system wound up being fed this bogus data, which caused the flight management system to aggressively correct the altitude of the plane, you know, in a couple of different directions, which resulted in a bunch of passengers being really quite badly injured, which is, I guess, a testament to how tough they build the aircraft. But have there been any procedures around dealing with that sort of situation? Because that's a similar sort of situation, whether or not the erroneous data is caused by an attacker or by a malfunctioning sensor. The principle's kind of the same.
And it's an event like that that does change airliners throughout the world. So from that one particular event, and the Air France incident also played a vital role, we have a procedure now where if we have any erroneous information that's presented itself to the flight deck, and particularly uncommanded climbs, speed reductions or speed increases, we now turn off two of the three flight control computers. So it reverts to basically a conventional aircraft, and we're back to hand flying and controlling the thrust manually, so the autopilot won't chase any changes that the computer's saying that we've either lost altitude or gained altitude.
So you're basically cutting back to the dumbest form of computer, which is more or less like a flight controller more than a flight computer, you'd say.
Yeah, of course. We've also lost all our redundancy, but in a situation like that...
That's what it's for, right?
It's exactly what it's for, but in that particular case, the computers are trying to correct a problem that doesn't exist. So by turning off two computers, having only one available, reverse to a normal aircraft, and then we manually control the aircraft. You lose all redundancy, you lose all protection, but in a sense, it just becomes a normal Cessna.
So it becomes a dumb plane then?
Absolutely becomes a dumb plane, and us dumb pilots would have to fly it, and we don't fly aircraft really.
So, you know, how do you think people would do flying a stick flying an Airbus?
Well, it would be a challenge. It would be a real challenge. We do practice that in the sim, probably not often enough because it doesn't happen. It's never happened. Airbus say if it does happen, it's for momentary excursions, and then you should be able to isolate enough of the problems to turn back most of your computers back on so that you're not flying. I don't want us flying the aircraft, basically.
Yeah, well, I always heard the joke of Airbus, you know, they need a guy in the front and a monkey with a stick, which is there to hit the guy if he tries to touch anything.
Absolutely.
So what, I mean, I'm wondering if, say you couldn't trust your flight computer, you couldn't trust your ECAM messages. How much of a problem is that on the flight deck?
Well, it's a huge problem. We can turn off our flight warning computer, which we have two of. The best thing is there's redundancy on top of redundancy. So the idea being if one fails, we can isolate that particular computer and then we still have a completely trustworthy backup. But if that I would imagine if they had the ability to override our computers, they would be able to override both computers. So even if we isolated one, the problem would still present itself.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. The approach of the aircraft manufacturers is to not talk about it. So we don't actually know. The redundancy might be really sensible, but, you know, that's not something that they're willing to share. I guess one of the issues could really be that you're not going to know if your flight computer's playing tricks on you. I mean, when I sort of think about this, because as I say, this has come up in our industry a bit, I think the you know, probably the spooky bit is you might not know that your flight computer is doing something funky. I mean, does that ever happen? Do they ever malfunction? And are there manual checks where you're checking, you know, airspeed and altimeter and, you know, expecting, you know, cross-referencing that with values against your computer, things like that? Like, how much time do you spend checking to see that your flight computer is doing what it's supposed to be doing?
There's not a lot of cross-checking, because when something fails, it goes ding, and then we're faced with a series of actions to correct it. But often there are problems that that occur on the flight deck where it's a faulty computer. We do a reset, and that's fine. Any ECAM that we do get, we treat as being as real, and we can further identify other problems through different computers just to confirm either A, it is broken, or B, it's a faulty computer. But I would think if they did have the ability to give us messages that were non-existent, we'd have to continue with the ECAM. We can hit an emergency clear button on all problems. So if the problem keeps recurring and we know that it's faulty, there's an emergency clear, which won't give us the same warning. But if they can trigger a warning, I would imagine they can override that as well.
So it's really just about, like, someone could just flood you with a whole bunch of messages that are going to trigger you to perform a whole bunch of manual processes in the cabin and take up your time.
Well, yeah, that'd take up our time, but that'd certainly, well, we'd actually divert. If we were flooded with ECAM problems and there was nothing to back them up as being real, we would then, I guess...
this, let's land.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But the worrying thing is there's nothing in our documents at all to troubleshoot for something if we suspected someone was interfering with our computers.
I wonder how long it's going to be before they actually start factoring this into their thinking. I guess what you were saying before is really that it needs to cause a tangible problem before anything's going to change.
Absolutely. With aviation, until something does cause a tangible problem, it's, you know, see no evil, hear no evil. It needs to happen before any of the big companies, you know, i.e. Boeing or Airbus, would introduce a change. And they can introduce changes which last 6 months, or they can incorporate changes which remain fixed in our manuals.
With your knowledge of the aircraft that you fly, would it be possible to design procedures? And I'm not talking about making, you know, technological changes to the aircraft. Would it be possible to design checks and procedures that would sort of mitigate the risk a little bit?
Oh, it'd be hard, because without having a complete understanding of how all the flight control computers work and all the other primary computers that we have on board the aircraft, it'd be really hard. The way they teach you to fly an aircraft now is all about being procedural. So if you can't fix it through the procedure that's been put in place, you can definitely troubleshoot outside the square, but it's not encouraged. And you're not being backed then either. If you do anything at all outside of the manual, and this is how every pilot operates, how's it going to hold up in a court of law? It wouldn't take an incredibly intelligent lawyer to say, well, okay, you haven't covered anything here. You've gone out on a limb, you're on your own, there goes your license, there goes your job.
So it really is stick to the procedure, and you can't foresee that a procedural change is going to mitigate it. I mean, you know, we are talking hypotheticals here. We should point out, we are talking hypotheticals. You know, Chris Roberts says he can issue climb commands through the IFR, like other people are calling bullshit on that. So it very much is a hypothetical, but it's still nonetheless an interesting one, which is, you know, if someone sitting on the plane is able to, through a laptop and a, you know, wired connection through the seat back or whatever, if they're able to issue a climb command to the flight computer, I mean, that is pretty difficult to mitigate, isn't it?
Oh, incredibly difficult. We'd have no idea where it was coming from. We'd have to assume...
Well, you would know it was happening, wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely, we'd know it's happening. But what we can do is isolate all the power to the in-flight entertainment, so commercial galley. If we could depower those systems, which we can, we'd be fine, but we would never assume that someone's hacked into a system. So to even do that would...
Yeah, you might not think to do it, I think is what you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. We wouldn't think to do it.
So I'm imagining your altimeter, things like that. I mean, are these readings, like when you look at your altimeter, do you happen to know if that data is being passed through the flight computer, or are there multiple paths for that? I mean, do you have multiple altimeters and things like that that you look at, or is all of the data that you're presented with when you're flying an aircraft, does that all come from the flight computer? The reason I ask is that it would seem to me that it would be very difficult to take over a flight computer, change the altitude of the aircraft, and then have that not noticed by the flight deck.
You would notice straight away. We would get an alarm, for one, to say that we've left our altitude. You get speed excursions, we're told everything. That's quite a big deal to that checklist. We'd go for the unreliable airspeed, which is essentially what Air France should have done. You know, if they did nothing, it would have self-fixed and they would have been able to complete the flight with the autopilot on, no dramas.
So it really sounds like what you're saying to me is that it would be possible for, you know, say, you know, under the hypothetical scenario that someone can mess with a flight computer or issue erroneous warnings, you know, through the various comm systems on the plane. It sounds like it would generate a bit of confusion in the cockpit, but it wouldn't necessarily lead to an attacker, you know, a digital attacker being able to do something really drastic to the plane, because worst comes to worst, you pull the pin on all the things and you stick fly it, right?
Exactly. And the idea of it happening is so remote. That's why pilots have never discussed it. There's so much redundancy, and I just can't imagine there ever being a time or place where a hacker would be able to jump on board and have enough input to have dire consequences. It's completely unrealistic, I think.
Well, I mean, that's good to hear, right? Because most of our listeners, you know, they just spend all of their time dealing with computer security problems and they realize how poorly secured computers are. But, you know, it seems like a lot of the redundancy in aircraft, and, you know, my training was as an engineer and we did touch on aviation design. There's usually seven layers of redundancy for each individual system. So it's very, you know, they're very seriously put together, these things. So even though they're not designed necessarily to deal with a malicious attacker, they are designed so that components can be just sort of cut out of the equation.
Yeah, for sure. But my one concern would be if they had the ability to hack into any one of our computers, whether we've got redundancy or not, I would think they'd have the ability to take over the computers, which that would definitely present issues. But I just can't see it happening.
But you're saying you can pull the power to those things anyway, right?
We can pull the power, but it would be, how would we identify that it's that particular computer's been hacked? So if they had...
You need to know that it's hacked? I mean, surely you just need to know it's not doing what you're telling it to.
Yeah, of course. But and if it was that obvious, then we'd simply pull a circuit breaker, turn off the computer, and yeah, it's fine. You continue with the remaining systems on board the aircraft and it wouldn't be a problem at all. But...
it still makes you feel funny in the pants?
Yeah, absolutely. If someone has the ability to turn off computers, that definitely presents problems.
That was John, our mystery pilot there. Big thanks to him. Now, look, keep in mind, even if an attacker could issue commands to the flight control system at the same level of authentication as a pilot, an Airbus computer basically won't let the pilot crash the plane. You can throw completely crazy inputs at these things from the pilot side, and eventually it just says F you and it deactivates the stick. I'm not kidding. So, you know, sure, you could maybe change course or alter attitude, but then you'd get, you know, there'd be an airspeed or altitude departure warning from other systems. You know, could you route the FCS somehow and reflash it with some sort of crazy firmware that lets you do what you want? Maybe, but then signed updates would fix that pretty easily. So, you know, I'm not saying that this isn't an issue, but what I am saying is that from the looks of things, it's something that appears mitigatable. You know, I mean, it looks pretty easy to mitigate by powering down the in-flight entertainment system if your computer starts going funky, or at worst, you just turn off the affected systems. When it comes to aviation security, I think we do need to keep our heads and realize that recent research rumors aren't the end of the world. If there is a risk there, it shouldn't be too hard to mitigate through some minor changes and some updated pilot training and procedures. But tell me what you think. I am Risky Business on Twitter, one word. Okay, on to this week's sponsor interview now with Marcus Ranham of Tenable Network Security. Tenable makes great vulnerability scanning technology in the form of Nessus, and they make great SIEM gear too, and you can check them out at tenable.com. This week, I wanted to continue with a theme that I've been running with on the podcast for the last month or so, which is talking about detection concepts. I did some research a while ago here in Australia and found that the CSOs I talked to didn't really expect their outsourced IDS monitoring to do anything useful. It's something that I've mentioned on the show previously. There are too many false positives. And in one case, I spoke to a CSO who said he trialed a service, a monitoring service from a large security brand, and it didn't catch any of the actual attacks that his company picked up with their own monitoring. And these were legit attacks. So there's a false negative issue there as well. So I wanted to talk to Marcus about whether or not we should wind back the focus on trying to use IDS to stop badness and go back to just logging what's going on and maybe using LAN honeypots to give you high fidelity indications that something bad is happening on your network. As you'll hear, Marcus says that's a dangerous and lazy approach and there are better ways to do it. Here's what he had to say.
The real problem with this when people say, oh, we're not getting the value out of our logs is because their networks are built wrong. I mean, if your network is a big single flat topology thing and you're allowing everything outbound and a whole lot of stuff inbound, well, yeah, of course your logs are going to be huge and unmanageable and useless. It's because you don't actually really have any security.
See, I've just always wondered, like with these new things like TrapX, with Haroon Mir's thing, Canary, with these sort of commercial honeypots, I think CrowdStrike have something like this as well. I've really wondered what would be wrong instead of having this monitoring piece being done by these external organizations and they're tripping on all sorts of signatures and stuff. What would be wrong with deploying a whole bunch of honeypots internally and then doing full packet capture across your network using something like, you know, there's the Packet Loop guys who sold off to Arbor. There's the RSA NetWitness solution, something like that, that just does full capture. And you just use your honeypots to alert. Your honeypot alerts, then you load up your console, you can roll back and then, you know, step through. Like, what's wrong with that approach?
Well, what's wrong with that is it's not going to work because the organizations that are so incompetent that they've basically got these wide open networks where they have those kinds of problems are also so incompetent that they would balk at the idea of being able to go back through their traffic because they wouldn't understand it and there's too much of it.
Yeah, but what about the organizations with sensible topologies? I mean, they still get owned as well, Marcus.
Well, the organizations with sensible topologies are going to be able to do a lot of this simply using firewall rules with permit deny log attached to it. So, for example, if you've got your network broken up into zones and you know that as a matter of policy, people on the R&D guest network generally shouldn't be trying to talk to people in the human resources department, you can put a firewall rule in place that says traffic from R&D to HR department permit and log, and then have that pop up in your SIM with an alert that, you know, something unusual is happening. The problem is you have to divide your network apart logically or physically. Physically obviously gives you protections, but logically allows you to organize how you're going to look at the data. I think the big problem with most of what's happening with detection is people are trying to put all their data into one bucket and then automatically sort that bucket apart, which if you think about that for a second is really kind of stupid. What you want to do is you want to partition things fairly carefully so things go into lots and lots of little thimble-sized piles of data. Okay, that's a terrible analogy, but you know, instead of putting everything into a haystack, what you should have is very small, manageable piles of hay that you can look at on a case-by-case basis. And then you can understand the relationship of the things going on between your little individual haystacks. So you know, it's back to what I was saying earlier. The premise of a lot of organizations is now that we've built this horrible flat topology network that has no security, I'm going to complain that the security products don't help me. Well, the real problem is that you built a really terrible, badly designed network. And there's actually nothing that can help you once you've done that.
Well, although, I mean, a lot of the pen testers I speak, when they get to go red team, right, what they're going to do is they're going to pop the domain admin's box. They might do some OSINT collection from outside the organization. They figure out who's likely to have credentials. They own them, and then they explore the network as them. Okay, so this is, you know, this is a problem that no matter how good your network topology is, no matter how good your firewall rules are, you're not going to spot that. Okay?
No, absolutely. Absolutely, you're going to spot that. First off, if your domain admins are some kind of a privileged access management system that locks them down. If you're just using Active Directory and people are logging as admins, yes, you have a stupid, badly built network. You are going to get owned. That's the reality of things, right? Now, if you have a network where you've got the administrative credentials are locked down and are being managed somehow, now any attempt to use administrative credentials any place in your network that bypasses that system that does credential management is an extremely important event. So if you design your network so that the flow of events that should happen is understood, what you do is you subtract everything that should happen from your complete set of events, and then everything that is left over is stuff that shouldn't be happening. And that's actually the only intrusion detection algorithm that really works. It's the only way of being able to actually detect unusual, abnormal, and unknown events is to know what should and shouldn't happen. The stuff that you know shouldn't happen, you put an alert on. The stuff that you know should happen, you effectively whitelist. And then everything that falls into that gray list is the stuff you have to look at.
But isn't the problem with that approach that, you know, the behaviors on modern enterprise networks are so complicated that it's difficult to actually find a whitelist that catches all legitimate behavior? And then you've got the issue of all of these false positives. You know, again, when say the, okay, we're migrating a database over here, or we're doing this, or we're doing that, and then everything's like, whoop, 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 you know? I mean, then we're just back to square one with too many false positives.
Yeah, no, but you're jumping right back to the presumption that you're dealing with a totally badly designed network. I mean, if your network is designed such that every single desktop in your enterprise can talk to the database server in the data center, your network is badly designed. But if you can say, oh, well, what we're going to do is we're going to have an Active Directory group for DB admins, and we're going to use some kind of privileged access management on that, and any attempts by anyone who's not DB admin to access these particular machines in the data center is going to generate an alert, then you can actually start to move away from false positives. You're moving into a zone where you're actually looking at policy-centric alerting and policy-centric detection and management. And that's, you know, and usually when I say this, people go, wow, that's difficult. Well, what about getting owned constantly is exactly easy. And the problem is that the way people build networks with these kinds of flat topologies and no notion of what should and shouldn't happen, that's why everybody gets owned. And, you know, so, you know, a lot of people in security are sitting here kind of going, well, we want to continue to do things the dumb, stupid, easy, lazy way that we've been doing them, but we also want to complain that that doesn't work. I'm sorry, pick one.
But wouldn't it be a victory for the industry if we could allow people to run the networks how we wanted and still catch bad behavior? I mean, what you're describing in terms of the perfectly architected, constructed network, this sounds very much like a perfect world scenario.
It doesn't have to be perfectly architected. It just has to be good. I mean, obviously, you can head towards perfect. But I mean, if you can just simply say, you know, hey, here's a crazy thought, okay? Let's say we can identify which is the CEO's desktop. And then really, seriously, who should be accessing the CEO's desktop? And if the answer is the CEO sitting at their desk, then you've got a very simple policy that you can put on just that and start there and move downhill from there. You don't have to boil the entire ocean. You just simply have to understand what should and shouldn't be happening in your network. And yes, it would be absolute nirvana if people could build stupid, badly designed networks that were wide open and had too much access and still be happy. But how's that working for you?
Yeah, I mean this is why I wonder, okay, you know, going back to the original premise, right, the original question is surely deploying honeypots on your LAN, okay, and then having some sort of, you know, I mean, this is what I like about these full packet capture things, right? You put in network taps at the right spot, you just buy a shitload of disk, you ingest all of this information. If you get a high fidelity alert, okay, because we already know that CSOs are not really bothering to look at their monitoring, right? They're not bothering. But if you've got high fidelity alerts that tell you, hey, you know, there's someone on your network trying to steal your shit, then you can actually go to your magic console and go, and you've got a starting point for an investigation at least then. I mean, this is the only high fidelity indicator I can think of besides your database being linked to in Pastebin.
Yeah. Yeah, except you're kind of barking up the wrong tree, because by the term high fidelity alert, I mean, look, the truth is, if you're getting a high fidelity alert, you don't need to go back and look at the packets. I mean, a high fidelity alert, or a well-constructed alert that's policy-centric, that's based on what shouldn't happen, is going to consist of something like, let's say you've made the decision that nobody should be trying to access the CEO's desktop except for from the CEO's desk. So you put some stuff in some of your core switches, so it attempts to connect to the CEO's desktop over the network, are going to get redirected to this honeypot that you're talking about. Well, that's kind of cool. And the honeypot could have some file share areas. So as soon as someone tries to download stuff from the file share area that looks like the CEO's machine, it's going to fire an alert. Okay, at that point, you don't need the packets, right? Because you're going to get an alert that says, this IP address on our internal network tried to access these files from the CEO's machine, and that's a no-no. Believe me, you're not going to need the detailed information that's in the packets. You're going to look at the flow information, and you're going to know right away from there. So this comes back to what I was saying earlier. You want to construct your event notification process around an idea of what shouldn't happen. And if you do that, it becomes self-diagnosing. At the point where you say, you know, this particular IP address in our network has tried to connect to 275 machines in today that it normally never connects to. And by normally, I mean not on a whitelist, right? Or not in its same zone. And the zone doesn't have to necessarily be a separate network. The zone could be a logical zone applied as an overlay on top of the network. And that, you know, you can do that with any of the commercial current generation firewalls. That's the kind of stuff I'm talking about. So you don't have to necessarily build a honeypot. You could actually use your existing switch architecture and firewall rules to build that same kind of logic, right? I mean, if you know that people in the R&D network shouldn't be connecting to people in the HR network, then the only thing you need to effectuate that rule as a policy-centric alert is to know the IP address ranges of that R&D network and the IP addresses of the HR machines. You weld that all together out of your switch or in a firewall rule, and you can use one of these next generation switch on a chip firewalls, next generation, formerly known as next generation, now current generation firewalls. You know, those things will also operate in sniffer mode. And, you know, back to this idea of collecting all the packets, if you've got something like a, you know, a Fortinet or a Palo Alto or one of these, you know, high-end layer 7 analyzing firewalls that's just sitting there acting as a sniffer, the log data that's going to come back from that is going to be so precise, you're not going to need the packets.
The broader thing I was talking about was having some sort of easy to deploy either full packet capture or logs. My point was not so much about packet capture as a technology itself. My point was more about, hey, maybe we could drop a whole bunch of honeypots and then have something that we can roll back through later. I mean, and this would seem to be a better investment on in terms of, you know, value per dollar than spending all of your money on some sort of monitoring company who's just going to have some, you know, some SOC based somewhere where they can pay people $5 an hour to give you your daily digest of false positives in an email, right?
Well, the problem that those guys have, and the reason why I think that they are not exactly doomed to failure, but they've got their work cut out for them, is because the guys who are sitting in some SOC and the folks who are building these offsite monitoring techniques, they don't know anything about your network. They don't know anything about your policies. They don't know anything about what should and shouldn't happen. That's information that only you can provide. And honestly, if you can provide that information, you should be able to provide it to yourself. But, you know, you could, again, you could do this using pretty much anything. I don't think you need a lot of honeypots. I think you need, you know, maybe one. And if you've got a couple of firewalls that are close to your core, you could have as many IP addresses as you want all get mapped down to that single honeypot for all I care, right? So if you've got a honeypot that's pretending to be the CEO's desktop, it becomes a very simple set of firewall rules to also have that honeypot look like an entire cluster of machines and human resources that you want. The problem is if you make your honeypots too big and too profuse, you're right back in the problem you're complaining about earlier, that you've got too much data and it's become nebulous. What you need to do is you need to target very carefully what you're afraid of happening. And for everything that you're afraid of happening on your network, you should ask, what would it look like if that thing I'm afraid of happening actually were happening? And then you put something in place to detect that.
All right. Well, Marcus Ranham, thank you very much for joining us with your thoughts on some old school approaches to doing it right. Much appreciated.
Anytime.
Marcus Ranham of Tenable Network Security there. Big thanks to Tenable for its support of the Risky Business Podcast. My takeaway from that chat is, you know, Marcus is basically saying you can achieve the same result as dropping honeypots by carefully setting up your network to alert on these policy violations, which actually does make a lot of sense. I'm just not sure which approach is easier. Again, if you have an opinion, hit me up on Twitter. I am just Risky Business, one word. And that is it for this week's show. This week's feature track is by a Melbourne-based salsa band called Quarter Street, and it's called Fantasia. One of the things I miss most about living in Melbourne is going to see bands like this. I mean, you could go see go out on a Sunday night and see a 14-piece Latin funk orchestra for free. This one is a free download. I'll link to it in this week's show notes. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Todos saben que tú vives la vida en un ambiente de ilusión. Por eso aquí estoy yo, óyelo, para bajarte de ese caballo en el que usted se me montó. Tú dices que eres el bravo, el rey de toda la calle y del tambo, pero se equivocó, porque yo vine a mostrarte cómo gozarla, pero con mucho sabor. Retumbaré esta tierra, la vida prestada, mi pana, y que fácilmente todo se acaba. Por eso yo voy a cantarte mi coro que dice así. Oye, qué fantasía, men.
Tú vives la vida en un mundo de ilusiones y fantasía.
Oye, qué triste la fantasía. Alicia en el país de la maravilla.
La vida en un mundo de ilusiones y fantasía.
Ay, qué tristeza me da tu caso. Y en verdad sí que vives un fracaso.
Tú vives la vida en un mundo de ilusiones y fantasía.
Oye, que está sudando la gota fría con mi ritmo y con mi melodía.
Tú vives la vida en un mundo de ilusiones y fantasía.
Tu fantasía de hacer el bravo y de mi mambo serás esclavo. ¡Muévete, muévete! Porque llegué con la cuore.
De mambo quiero darte, pa' ver si tu mente se afina.
Pita, baby.
Una galleta de mambo quiero darte, pa' ver si tu mente se afina. Una galleta de mambo quiero darte, pa' ver si tu mente se afina.
Ruénalo, baby.
Una galleta de